Pasidipat Pavakat Dispulingaha Pavakat Dispulingaha Sahasrashaha Sahasrashaha Prabhavante Sarupaha Prabhavante Sarupaha Tataksharat Tataksharat Vivida Somya Bhavaha Vivida Somya Bhavaha Prajayante Prajayante Tetrachaiva Piyanti Tetrachaiva Piyanti Sindhi Tet Etet Satyam Yata Sudiptat Pavakat Vispulingaha Sahasrashaha Prabhavante Sarupaha Tata Aksharat Vividaha Somya Bhavaha Prajayante Tetra Cha Eva Api Yanti. Today, Satsatsyam, earlier in the previous chapter, the mantra also started with Today, Satsatsyam. Today, Satsatsyam means that which we're talking about, which is Brahman, is this. That is this that we've been talking, that which we've been talking about. That is Satsyam, that is the truth. Previously, we were saying that is the truth. We were talking about karmapala, meaning in reference to the karmakanda, in reference to the whole creation, every karma, according to the laws of the creation, will produce a result, period. There is a result for every action. And that result is a product of all the infinite organization of all of the laws of the creation. So that is the truth. But it's a relative truth, because all of these karma polas, the karmas will produce polas, and those polas are true, but they are all finite and subject to change. Nevertheless, within the empirical order of the creation, karmas, actions do produce results. So to make that point, and to say, yes, what the Vedas are teaching, what is being taught in terms of the rituals and all of these all of the things that you learn in the Karmakanda, yes, these are true. These do produce these results. That's Satyam. Now, here, when we're talking about Paravidya, that was all Aparavidya. Right? Aparavidya means the so-called lower vidya. And because it's all existing within ajnanam, within avidya, within ignorance. And it all is time-bound. So it can't produce anything lasting. And so even though it has an empirical reality, and that empirical reality is an order of reality, an order of objective reality, that objective reality is bound by ajnanam, is a product of ajnanam, a product of ignorance, and subject to change. Paravidya is not an empirical reality, it's an absolute reality. What the Paravidya is talking about, it's not what we call Vyavaharika Satyam. Vyavaharika Satyam means the empirical reality. Maya. I don't imagine this. I, as an individual, I'm not projecting the rug. I'm not projecting the universe. In fact, I'm part of the projected universe. Right? This jiva, body, mind, sense organs, is part of the projected universe. I can project something, like I can imagine a snake on a rope, for instance. That's Pratibhasika. Subjective reality. But this is an empirical reality which includes the physical body, the mind, sense organs, and the subjective reality that is projected upon the empirical reality. Right? That I can project a snake on a rope is a possibility that exists within empirical reality. So that has its own order of reality. But that order of reality is what we call mitya. Means it has no independent existence apart from what we call absolute reality, the Paramarthika Satyam. Paramartika means absolute. Paramartika satyam means the absolute truth, the absolute satyam, the absolute existence, meaning that which is not bound by time, that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. That's the definition of paramartika satyam. So this, now we're in the paravidya, that higher knowledge, which is dealing with absolute reality, which is the nature of Brahman, the nature of the self, which is Brahman, the absolute being, which is not subject to any change whatsoever. And so now, when the Upanishads, we've already finished now with the Karma Kanda, having told what all of the karmas are, what are the highest, that the highest rewards, the highest you can go in terms of karma pala, within the creation, within avidya, and it told, you know, it told in glowing terms, you know, the highest heavens that you can get. And it even had the angel saying, come, 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 welcome, welcome, welcome. Right? And then after having explained all of this, it then deconstructed all of it, saying all of this is there. It's all satyam. It's all real. It's all true. It all can be achieved. There are laws. You can get there. But what you are getting is finite. No matter how long it may last, if it's existing with time, within time, and the result of a karma, the result of the time-bound karma will itself be time-bound. And so there is no freedom here. This is not moksha. You can just have elongated, short little pleasures or elongated pleasures, right? But short pleasures or elongated pleasures are all bordered by dukkha. Why? Because the end of a pleasure is sorrow. Right? We don't give up our happiness happily, right? So if a happiness comes to an end, which is the product of a situational happiness, because it's a product of the situation comes to an end, that's our sorrow. So sukha, that's why we have sukha, dukkha, sukha, dukkha, sukha, dukkha. Why it rotates like that? Because it has to. Because no situation is permanent. So all of this was deconstructed in order to make the student recognize fully the problem, to turn the mumukshu really into, to heighten the mumukshitvam, the desire for liberation on the part of the student, and then to convert that mumukshitvam into what we call jignyasa, the desire to know. And this was the parikshalokan verse that we did. It converts the mumukshitvam, the student is converted from a mumukshu, one who desires liberation, to one who desires knowledge, because recognizing that the only means there can be for liberation is knowledge. Because action, karma, by its very nature, produces a result. And because it produces a result, it is time-bound. And since it is time-bound, then I'm just still stuck in samsara. And so, if I want moksha, freedom from samsara, I have to, in fact, already be that. If I'm not already being that, if I'm not already that in reality, I would have to become that. If I become that, I become a product of change within time. And therefore, there is no such thing as freedom from samsara. And so I either am that, or I'm not. If I'm not, there's no amount of knowledge or action that can make me that, free from samsara. If I am that, if I am free from samsara, if my being already is full and complete, there is no amount of action that can give me that, because I already have it. I already am that. So what amount of action will help me to become what I already am? So now, the question is not one of doing, because I already am that, but I don't know it. And so then the solution now becomes knowledge. Okay? And what is going to give me that knowledge? And that's the problem. So the problem is this my sense organs are going to give me knowledge, my means of knowledge that I have available to me. They will give me knowledge of samsara. They'll give me knowledge of the creation. They'll give me knowledge of the thoughts in my mind. They'll give me knowledge of experiences in my mind. They'll give me knowledge of this, just the thoughts shall be anything I can witness in the mind, I can gain knowledge of that. Or any through perceptions, I can gain knowledge of that. That's what my sense organs can give me. That's what my means of knowledge can give me, with inference and presumption and all of these other things are all based upon sense perception. They can't give me knowledge of myself. And so self-knowledge, who I actually am, is considered in the Vedanta to be Shastra-Vedya. It's something which is to be gained, a knowledge which is to be gained through the Shastra. It's called Shastra-Vedya, that which is to be known through the Shastra, through the scripture, through the Upanishads. And so now this is the problem. It's obvious to me, it can be obvious as we deconstruct this or analyze it, that you in fact can't know yourself through means of knowledge that are meant to know things other than yourself. In other words, I can't take my eyeballs out and pull them out and turn back to look at the awareness that's illumining them. The conscious being that's aware of the mind, that's aware of the eyes, that illumines the mind, that illumines the eyes, that illumines the physical body, that illumines the world. None of my sense organs are capable of giving me knowledge of that which is already a self-evident experience. In other words, I am already here as a conscious being. I am a conscious being that exists. I don't need sense perception to tell me that. Right? It's I, the conscious being, use my eyes. I, the conscious being, use my mind. I, the conscious being, have thoughts. So the conscious being that I am, doesn't, the experience of myself doesn't require sense perception to tell me that, or a mind to tell me that. I am and the thought is. Right? So my presence, in a way, if we can use language like this, precedes the thought. Right? I am, and so these thoughts are known. I am, and so these perceptions are known. I am the stable being who is always present to all of my experience. And so the self, my own presence is known to me experientially as a conscious being. So I don't need anyone to tell me that at all. We all know that. That's kind of a bottom line. But it's called samanya jnanam. It's the general given. I am, I am, I am. We all know that. But my sense organs can't tell me who I am. I can say, I am an existent being. But then if I were to say, yeah, I'm an existent being, but tell me about me. You know? What is this existent? Who is this existent being? Is this existent being that I am a part of the body or the mind or the sense organs? Is it different from you? What is the relationship of me to this creation? Do I come and go with the body? Is existence finite? What is it? So I have the experience, but I don't know what it is. So to know what it is, the Shastra will say it's Shastra-Vedya, something to be known by the Shastra. But some, a karmakandi, somebody who knows the karmakanda, the first portion of the Vedas, will say, well, how can that be? Because the Shastra only gives me knowledge of things that I can't know through my sense organs. That's what the Shastra is good for. It gives me knowledge of what I can't know through my sense organs. For instance, I don't know what the different heavens are. I don't know what happens to me after I die. I don't know how punya and papa work. I don't know what dharma is. I don't know all of these things. I have no means of knowledge. Shastra tells me all of that. Those things I can't know, you know. But how is the Shastra going to tell me who I am? How can I? This is the argument here. In terms of a karmakanda and the heaven worlds and all of these things that I can't experience, like, for instance, I do a ritual and it starts to rain. I don't know why it starts to rain. I know it starts to rain because I have Shraddha and the Shastra. And it tells me if I do this ritual, it starts to rain. I do the ritual, it starts to rain. The Shastra tells me, when I die, if I've done all of these karmas properly, I should go to Svargaloka. I have Shraddha in that. But it's indirect knowledge. I have indirect knowledge. I believe it. And I have indirect knowledge. Because actually, even with this example, if I do the ritual for rain and it starts to rain, I say, oh, wow, that's amazing. Some part of my mind will say, yeah, but it could be coincidence. Right? Or if the Shastra promises I'll go to heaven if I behave properly and do these rituals and whatnot, and I have Shraddha, and then I also say, and I hope it's true. That's belief. You know, that's the Shraddha. It's indirect knowledge. And so you believe it, you take it on faith, there's certain things that substantiate it, it can give it some strength for you, but you have no immediate knowledge of it. So now here, you say that the Vedas, I mean that the self is unknown and really is not something that can become an object of knowledge through your sense perception. And it's Shastra Vedya. And so now, are you saying that the Shastra then is going to give me indirect knowledge of myself? Right? Just like it gives indirect knowledge of the heaven worlds, it gives indirect knowledge of Dharma, etc. Of how the rituals work, indirect knowledge. Then am I supposed to be happy with the Shastra Vedya of myself? So the Shastra unfolds, you are Brahman. So is that going to be a belief for you? Yes, then you believe. Shastra says, I am Brahman. You know? The Shastra says, Advaita, your being is the being of all, your being is the one being of the entire creation. What kind of knowledge is it? Is it a belief? And so these verses now are going to tell you what type of a knowledge it is. It cannot be, the Shastra cannot here be in these, the verses will unfold it in this way. The knowledge the Shastra has to give you in terms of the Karmakanda, in terms of heaven worlds, indirect knowledge, because the heaven worlds are away from you. Those laws are away from you. You know, you are part of the whole, right? So you learn about something much greater than yourself or something on another loka, on another plane of existence that is away from you. So it has to be indirect knowledge. You are not away from yourself. The Atma, the self that the Shastra is revealing in terms of your nature in reference to the whole, is immediately present. And so now, the Shastra is not giving you a catechism of who you are, but rather it's functioning as a means of direct, immediate knowledge to give you what we call aparoksha jnanam of yourself. Aparoksha jnanam means the recognition, the vishesha jnanam. Vishesha jnanam means the particular knowledge of who exactly I am, this conscious being that is here as my own self-experience. It has nothing to do with some conscious being to be reached in some other way. It's this being that I am here right now. The Shastra, the whole intent of the Upanishad now is to reveal the nature of the self that I am as the whole. And that is direct, immediate knowledge, what we call aparoksha jnanam. Shankara, in his introduction here, to this chapter, talks us now the paravidya is beginning. After having done all of setting the student up to become a jignasu, one who wants to know, having now negated the efficacy of the karmakanda in terms of being able to give any type of moksha, right? It's now begins the paravidya, really the brahmavidya. And so Shankara says, now you'll see as this Upanishad continues, it's going to be using two types of lakshanas. The word lakshana often is just often defined as a definition. A lakshana is a definition. But the definition, we have to work on that a little bit to really understand what that means, because it's hard to define Brahman or to define the self. However, the self needs to be pointed to and there are two ways, because their self is immediately present. What words and what way can we use words to point to the nature of your being that is here? And so there's two different ways that your being is actually pointed to. One is called Tathastha Lakshana. Tathastha Lakshana uses other things to make you recognize the thing that you're trying to point to. The example they use for Tathastha Lakshana is, say for instance, one example they use is, you know, say you're in a little village, and in the village there's a row of houses, and all of the houses are exactly the same. You know, they're all mud huts, you know, and they all have red roofs, every single one of them. Exactly the same. And so this whole string of, and you want to point out to your friend your house. So you can't say, look at the house with the red roof. Okay? You know, look at the house with the, you know, with the brick walls. Why? Because every single one has a red roof. And every single one, you know, has a brick walls. They're all exactly the same. But on one of them, which happens to be your house, you notice on the chimney, there's a bird. So what you say is, do you see that bird on the chimney of that house? That's my house. And so the person sees the bird sitting on the house, and then seeing that the bird is on the house, therefore sees the house. Right? But because the bird, which has nothing to do with the house, right? You see the house. It's my house. Right? That's Tathastha Lakshana, where you're using something which is not exactly the object that you're trying to reveal, right? To reveal the object. Because there's an association. The bird's on that house and I was in any other house. That's Tathastha Lakshana. There's another type of Lakshana called Swarupa Lakshana, where you're actually using the words themselves to point to the object. Like say, for instance, in that string of houses, each one was different. One had a brick red roof, one had a black roof, one had a garden in the front. They're all different. Say your roof happened to be, you know, a white roof. And you said, oh, look at my house. Look at there, the one with the white roof. Now you're actually describing a quality of the object. I'm describing the roof. That belongs to the house. That's a lot different than describing the bird. So from the bird, you jump to the house. I describe the house, then I'm describing the house, you go right to the object itself. So in Vedanta, in recognizing yourself, we need to use both of these lakshanas. You need to use both of these lakshanas. Because we have to make you see that the conscious being that you are, which you now take yourself to be as this body, right? You take yourself to be this body with the sense organs of the mind, this whole jiva, this jiva complex. You take yourself to be this, right? Now, this body with your mind and sense organs enjoys consciousness. It enjoys amness, existence. That's why you can say, I am a conscious being. Right? However, when you say the I am a conscious being, you're referring to this body and mind and sense organs. So if I were to point out to you, you know the consciousness which your body enjoys? Right? That consciousness. You know the consciousness which your mind enjoys? That consciousness. In the end, we take the mind away from the consciousness, we take the body away from the consciousness, we take the sense organs away from the consciousness, we take the whole universe away from the consciousness, and recognize that consciousness is just pure Satchitananda. Right? That's the nature of consciousness. That's Swarupa Lakshana. The nature of consciousness is just pure conscious being. But we have to get to that. Right? How do we get to it? To test a lakshana. Because what if I were to say, you know the consciousness in the rug?
Too hard,
right? To get to the consciousness in the rug, I first have to get the consciousness which I've associated with the body, then recognize that the body is an object like the rug. Right? But I'm not going to get to the consciousness through the rug. I have to get to the consciousness through the body, through the mind. Because that's where the identification is in terms of this jiva. The rug does not have is not a jignyasu. If the rug isn't saying, oh, poor me, please liberate me. Like one Swamiji said, the chair is not complaining that I'm sitting on it. Right? It doesn't have a problem. Right? And so even though this physical body and this mind and these sense organs and the rug and the space, all of these things are actually objects. They're all equally known. Now think about it. This rug is known to me, this space is known to me, this table is known to me, this physical body is known to me, all through my sense organs. They're all objects of my knowledge. It's not like this body is less an object of my knowledge than that painting. The only reason I know this body is through the five sense organs. The only reason I know the painting is through the five sense organs. The only reason I know the intervening space is through the five sense organs. These are all objects. But because the identification with consciousness is with this body and not with the space, I use the body as a tatastha lakshana to recognize, to get to the awareness. You know the awareful being that's there in your body, the awareness that's there in your body? You know the awareness that's there in your mind, your thoughts, that all of the thoughts in your mind, each thought enjoys awareness? You know the awareness that's there in the mind? Tatastha lakshana. So I use the mind in order to, as a jumping off place, to make you recognize the awareness which is present to the mind. Once we do that, then when you see the awareness present to the mind, right, but then you can say something about that experience. Do you notice that the mind is always changing? Because we're talking about the awareness that is there in the mind. Now I'm asking you something else. Do you notice that the awareness that's there in the mind, the awareness doesn't change, but the thoughts continually change? Okay? So I'm getting to that awareness, the recognition of that awareness, as it through the mind, which acts as the tatastha lakshana. And then once I say, do you see that minds are always changing, that the awareness remains constant, the being remains constant, changeless, then we get to the sat-chit-ananda, to the nature of the awareness itself. Once we realize that this mind that got us to notice the awareness in the first place is actually objectified and changing as an object in a sense. So this, you see how this works? So we need to use both Swarupa Lakshana, the very nature of the self, and Tatastha Lakshana initially to get us there. Even here, in reference to the entire creation, the Advaita Vedanta is not just that I'm Satchitananda. It's that I am the whole. What that means is this is Satchitananda. Right? I say, I am Satchitananda, what about this? So I have to be able to say that I, who am Satchitananda, am this. That I am this. To be able to say I am this, I need to be able to use the tatastha lakshana to show that all of this that we're experiencing here, right, is nothing but Satchitananda. I have to be able to say that. Otherwise, I have to be able to use this universe to be able to say that this is nothing but Satchitananda. Otherwise, I, the subject, cannot be the object. And where does the idea of subject-object come in the first place? Because we're sitting in this universe. Well, here we are sitting in the room as a subject and an object. I have to be able to say that the subject is the object. That means that I have to acknowledge an object is here and the subject is here. Once I acknowledge it, there's the tatastha lakshana. I have to say that the being that this object enjoys is the being that I enjoy. You know, when the meditation, I said the amness is the isness. You say this amness, when we resolve the mind and recognize just my own presence, this amness that is there, present to all of the perceptions, present to the mind, this amness that is there, to recognize that this amness is the isness. There is no isness, there is no amness, there's just amness, or there just is isness, whichever word you want. But if you recognize that the amness is the isness, you know that there is no duality there, even on that level then you're recognizing in a way that Satchitananda is Satchitananda. Amness is isness. There is no duality. If I say amness is isness, that's the same as saying I am you. Right? That's the same as saying the subject is the object. And so then what we have to do is recognize that amness and then recognize it in reference to the mind. It's called the knower, the amness, the conscious being. In reference to the mind gets called the knower. In reference to objects in the mind gets called the known. Right? In reference just to the mind as an instrument of knowing, or I'm identifying with the consciousness, it gets called the knower. In reference to the object in the mind, it gets called the known. The knower and the known enjoy the same consciousness. There's not two consciousnesses. There's not a knower and a known. There's consciousness, which is superimposed upon the mind, and consciousness, which is superimposed upon the objects in the mind, knower, known. There is no knower, known, just like there's no amness and isness. Right? There's just consciousness that is then in relationship, labeled in relation to all of these different things. So that all has to become clear, and we use these devices of Tattvastha Lakshana and Swarupa Lakshana, playing them back and forth to be able to recognize in the end that there's nothing here but Satchitananda, that I am the whole. And so Shankara introduces this chapter with this, and then he begins the verse, saying, the verse begins, Kare Satyam, that Brahman that we've been talking about, that is Satyam. That is the truth. Paramarthika Satyam. That which exists in all three periods of time. And then he gives the example. He says, Yata, just as Sudipta Pavakat, just as from a pavaka. Pavaka is a fire, which is sudipta. Dipta means lit. Su means very well lit. Just as Abhutate sudipta ramat sudipta pavakat. Pavaka means that which purifies. Fire, like if you boil water or burn things to ashes, it's a pure, great purifier. So it's a word for fire. So just like a fire, which is sudipta, very well lit. From that fire of Vispulinga come many, many sparks. Right? All of the sparks that come from the fire are nothing but fire. I'll explain this drishtanta, this illustration in a minute, but just get the image now. There's a fire, well-lit fire, and this fire is sparkling, okay, crackling. And so it's putting forth lots of different sparks. All of Vispulinga means many and varied. All different little shapes, little sparks are coming, okay? But all of those sparks, they all have different shapes, you know, and they're all little individuals, but really, those sparks are nothing but fire. So he says, Yata Siddhita Pavaka Vispulingaha, all of these sparks, Vispulingaha like Ramaha, Samasa plural, all of these sparks, just as all the sparks, Sahasrashaha, thousands of them, okay, Prabhavante, they come forth, Sarupaha, all of them having the same content. They're all the same. They're the same form. They don't mean form as the psychic, the sparks will be all different form, but they're all the same, right? Because they're all fire. So thousands of sparks are being shot off of the fire, being born out of the fire, all of them exactly the same, being nothing but fire, okay? So these thousands of sparks, how they all come from the fire, tata, similarly, like that, aksharat. From the akshara, from Brahman. If you remember in the previous chapter, Brahman was defined as akshara. Akshara is that which never changes, what wavers. That's a word for Brahman. So from that one, who is the changeless, akshara, never diminishes, never changes, vividaha, somya, bhavaha. Somya means dear one. So it's hey dear one, addressing the student. Hey dear one. Svokya, somya. Bhavaha, all of the jivas. Bhavaha, nominative singular. Bhavaha. All of the jivas. Bhavas mean actually living beings. Or it could even mean any being that comes into existence. Shankara's taking it here now just for bhava, for the jivas. All of the jivas, all of the living beings, vividaha, multi and varied, all different sorts of them, so all of these variety of bhavas of jivas, all of them, prajayante, all of them are born. They come from the akshara, from Brahman. Tatricha evapiyanti, apiyanti, taken as apiyanti, and all of them go back to that alone. They go back into that alone. All of these jivas come from Brahman, and all of these jivas go back into Brahman alone. So what's the vision there? Every drishtanta has its limitations, so you have to understand what the drishtanta is trying to say. There's one fire, right? The sparks that come from the fire are nothing but fire. The upadi of the nama rupa, the name and form of the spark, is what differentiates it from the fire. But actually, fire is fire. That's the idea. But even though the illustration of the fire is limited because there's space between the sparks to give individuality. Whereas here with the Atma, there's no space between the Atma. Your Atma and my Atma, there's not space between the Atma. But you know what I'm saying? Where there's space between my body and your body. But there's not space between the Atma and the Atma. Right? There's one Atma. But because of the upadis, these Atmas appear to be different. So just imagine, there's one Brahman, but from the standpoint of this creation, there's all these little sparks. Here's a little spark, here's a little spark, here's a little spark, here's a little spark. Right? With space between the sparks. Right? All kinds of space between the sparks. And many varied sparks. Right? But what is the content of these sparks, and what is causing the differentiation, the difference between one spark and the other? That's the upadhi. The space itself is an upadhi. The body is an upadhi. Everything that's objectifiable becomes an upadhi, right? So if you look at it, this body is an upadhi. The sense organs are an upadhi. The mind is an upadhi, right? But now also, the space itself is objectifiable. So the Atma, which is the conscious being, right, becomes likened to these sparks because of the upadhis. But if the upadhis are removed, what is a spark is recognized as being just the fire. In other words, if you remove the upadhis, the awareness hasn't become a spark. See what I mean? The awareness remains as the awareness. The sparkiness is caused by the upadhis. There's no differentiation or separation in terms of the awareness. So like that, how they're using the example of the fire, fire remains fire. There's no differentiation between the fire at all. Except now, the upadhis are there. Take a look at the space in a sense as a maya, you know, that's allowing for all of these sparks to occur. It's not, no, don't think of it as fire becoming a separate little atma has broken off. That's not the idea. It's the fire, which is the fire of the whole, is the fire of the little ones, of the little sparks. Like that, the awareness of the whole is the awareness of all of the little ones. Awareness of the whole, which is the awareness of the entire creation, which is Brahman, the limitless awareness, is the awareness of all of the little ones. All of the little ones, what makes all the little ones little? The upadhi. If you remove the upadhi, you see that there has been no division for Brahman. That's the idea. Shankara, to try to make this more clear in his bhasha, says, just like space, think of it like space. Space can be defined by whatever container and whatever size container can be there. If you have a little pot, for instance, the space then becomes a small pot space. If you have a big pot, then you have a bigger space. The space is defined by the upadhi. Right? So if you have a big pot, you have a big space. If you have a little pot, you have a little space. And so even in this room, you know, there's all the space is broken up by the objects which are able to contain the space. But in reality, there is no containment for the space. Right? The space is in and through all of the objects. In fact, there is no little pot space or big pot space. There is no room space. There's only one space which is erroneously differentiated by the upadhis, right? And so that's where if I take a cup and I move it from A to B, space isn't moving, you know? You say, well, look, the cup space is moving. But there is no cup space moving, right? There is no division in space at all. Like that, in terms of your being, there is no division in being at all. There's no movement, right? But the upadhis make it look like there is little beings moving around, right? You're a little being and you're a little being, all little sparks, you know? All part, little sparks, part of the big. Big awareness is sparking out the little sparks, and the little sparks have to come back into the, merge back into the big awareness, you know? But what is separating awareness, the little sparks, from the whole? Maya. That which can be objectified. Anything that separates you from me, that makes me seem like a spark and you seem like a spark, is objectifiable. If it's objectifiable, it's not me. Space is objectifiable. The body is objectifiable. Sense organs are objectifiable. Awareness is not. And so the sparkiness of the awareness is a misnomer, really. It's a superimposition upon the upadhi. Whereas in fact, the conscious being that you are has nothing, no means to divide itself. Right? Unless I am this, unless the spark is this, unless awareness actually has become this and has become that, then there's a division. But if there's a subject-object relationship between consciousness and these objects that change within consciousness, there is no becoming, there's no objectification in order to make me different from you. Right? And so the sparks, what appear to be sparks or differences, are differences that are only brought about by the upadhis, and the upadhis are those things that can be objectified and differentiated from consciousness. And so the conscious being that you are, the spark that you are, is the spark which is the whole. Right? The spark that you take yourself to be is the consciousness of the whole. So we'll stop there and work on a little bit next year. Let's just take a minute. Oh wow, I forgot to tape. I brought Penny.
Yeah, you're Penny.
She has it. She and I both do it, so...
She's like very happy, you know. Her picture is never this.
The backup.
A female kind of happy.
When you were talking about Chitta Sulakshana and how
Okay.
And how the your brain and how the Dr. Fisher Vivekha is an example of going into where the identification is.
Yeah.
But then you said something about using the creation as a tataksalakshana as well.
Well, because I didn't develop that very much, but when I, the point that I was making is that in the end you have to recognize not just that you are Brahman, but that this is Brahman, right? And so we have to be able to see also that this rug is Brahman, right? That, and so to see that this rug is Brahman, I'm pointing to Brahman through the rug. That's all. So I'm using the rug to make you recognize that there's nothing here but Brahman. But the, but still, to get to be able to recognize that all of this is Brahman, I need to really first recognize that this self is free from this body. Because once I recognize that the self is free from this body and mind and sense organs, then the body, mind, sense organs, everything that makes for the identification, all of you parties, become part of the whole, of Ishwar, of the creation. Once that happens, then we can do the tatasva lakshana even on the creation. Right? Because, but now all of the jiva belongs to the creation. And then we can take apart this creation, you know, how this creation is infinitely divisible, and all that's left is the being, how everything that comes, that everything that we experience in the creation comes into being and goes out of being. All of these are pointing to the changeless through the changing. Right? And so that's how we're using tataksa lakshana. Then when we look at what is the nature of Brahman, the Sat-Chit-Ananda, that which is just changeless being, pure consciousness, pure being, that which is limitless, then we're using the Swarupa lakshana, to the point to the very nature of awareness. The point to the very nature of awareness, you need to deconstruct, in a sense, all of the things that are taken to be that awareness. The easiest way to do that is to go through the self to release all of the upadis into the creation, and then to look at the creation. Once you release all of the upadis into the creation, then the self is free. Right? Because it's not in the shape of anything that you've objectified. So now the self is free. It's such shit on that you recognize that. But you're still left with the creation. So now you have to see that this creation is only such shit on under. But to do that, then you have to go back into looking at the such shit on under, getting to the such shit on under as the very being of the creation. So you use the creation to get to the very being of the creation. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then that experience of seeing Brahman and the creation is only seen from Satchitananda itself, right? I mean, that the location of that, if I could speak that way of saying it, doesn't change.
That's right. It doesn't change at all. It's just that you recognize that in this, the experience of the universe, right, that this body, mind, sense organs belongs as much to the, it is part of the experience of the universe. And the experience of the universe is not at all away from your being. Okay? And no object in this universe has any substance of its own, because all of it is infinitely divisible. All of it comes and goes in time. You can't find anything. You can never establish anything here. And as you go on trying to establish any given reality, or anything that you experience here within time and space, all you find, the only stability that anything is left with is being itself, is knownness itself. It's just the beingness and the knownness doesn't belong to an object. It's not dependent on an object. It's just the very substance, the very foundation of everything that is. You can't find an object. You know, you can find conglomerates, infinitely divisible conglomerates. You can't find the thing. And then you understand that you get to the, conceptually, the idea of the smallest object. So imagine the smallest object. You want to get to the substance of the imagined smallest object. You want to get to the substance of it. Take off the form. You have to take off the form. Because the form is only mithya. It's only, if the form of anything is only dependent on its substance. Like the pot is mithya. It's only dependent on the clay. It has no, there's the only thing that's there is clay, right? So the pot is mithya. See that? So say the clay pot stands for a form. And now imagine the smallest form. The smallest form. Smallest form still takes up space. You've got to take off you want to get to the substance. You need to remove the form, the mithya. So you do that. What's there? The formless. So in the end, and what is the formless? It's being, the being which the form is enjoying. What is that being? This non-objectifiable being is the amness, which is the isness. And anything you do, you take any object, it doesn't matter what it is, any object in the creation, any experience, it doesn't make any difference. What remains always, as you take it apart and dissect it and deconstruct it or whatever, what remains as the constant, as these things are removed and removed and broken down, is the being. This thing is, now this thing is, now this thing is, now this thing is. The is this non-objectifiable being of every experience, which is really the amness. There is no isness, because the amness, the isness is the amness. There's no objectifiable experience of amness for there really to be any isness. In other words, there's no objectifiable experience of amness for there to be any such thing as isness. You never experience isness. No, but you take your own amness in reference to the painting, and you call it isness. Painting is, but your experience is only am. Right? That when you say aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, right? I am Brahman. Or prajnanam Brahma. Brahman is consciousness. Consciousness is not an objectifiable experience, like space or something. Yeah. It's the nature of the subject. I am Atma Brahma. This Atma is Brahman. This Atma, me, is Brahman. And everything always comes back to the self, because Advaita. Advaita means non-dual, one without a second. The reality is non-dual, one without a second. If it's non-dual, one without a second, it has to be you. Because there's nothing else. Right? Who else is it going to be? It's either you or you're not here. That's what it, you know. So that's the amness.
Right? Carol, that was a finite regression, though, that we did there when you come down to...
Finite.
Meaning that there is, it does end. So like when you come down to the isness,
It doesn't, because you can't get beyond that which is not objectifiable. There's nothing behind it. What can't be objectified has nothing behind it. Like, see, in terms of my experience of the creation, anything within Maya can be objectified. Like the space, then the objects, the body, the sense organs, the mind, the thoughts, the moods, the emotions, even the eye thought. These are all objectifiable. They're all changing. They all come to go. And they all have a subject-object relationship in the sense that they're known. But now, say you get rid of all these things, including space, and you're just left with the awareness, the conscious being. Now you try to objectify that. And you can't, because there's no one behind it. So you could say, well, awareness is aware of awareness. It's aware of awareness because it's self-evident, not because there's a subject-object relationship. There's not an awareness that's aware of another awareness. There's just the self-effulgence of awareness. You can't get behind that.
Well, when we do the example of objectifying the mind and doing that by layer,
Those are all
refer to an infinite regression. An infinite.
It's not an infinite regression.
Right.
Yeah.
It's finite.
It's finite regression. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because when you get to that which cannot be objectified, it's over. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Now, one thought can be aware of another thought. Like it can say something like, "I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about this." But these are all thoughts that are known. When you get to the awareness that illumines them, then that's not thinking about this or thinking about anything. It's the awareness that's illumining whatever the thought is.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So these upadis, is that a specific idea to explain Maya, how Maya works?
So, not exactly. Excuse me. The upadi is a point of identification. Like, for instance, this body is called an upadi because I can say I, the awareful being, am this body. So this body lends itself to that mistake. The body lends itself to that mistake of misidentification. So does the mind. So does the sense organs, right? So does the I thought. If you say, I am, it's just a thought.
Yeah.
But then you can think that that is you, that thought. So it acts as an upadi. Now, if I'm using the pot space example, I can say the pot is functioning as an illustration. The pot mistakes itself to have pot space. Like, there is no pot space. The space is, oh, I'm the size of the pot. Right, but there's no such thing as pot space.
Yeah.
So the pot becomes a new potty for the space because it can make the space think that it's limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How the mind are just is created out of thin air is part of a concept. Well, that thought also that I am you, that goes away as well. I mean, if you're just centered on awareness, there is no.
There is the thought, the I am you thought, or aham brahmasmi.
There is a thought, though. I mean, is that the technique to show something?
It's a thought that labels reality, and you recognize the reality when you say the words. The words are just a recognition of reality. And so you can use words like that, I am you.
Mm-hmm.
The mind can say statements like that to direct the mind toward what it knows as a meditation.
Yeah, because it sort of triggers.
Yeah, because it triggers the mind's own recognition mm-hmm. of what it knows. But nevertheless, the mind is in Maya.
Yeah.
The mind, the hum brahmasmi is in Maya. The jnanam, the knowledge is in Maya. But what's not in Maya is the self. But the Upanishads, which are also in Maya, reveal that which is the substance of Maya. They reveal the reality. And how can they do it? Only because you are that reality. Because you are there. You are there, abiding as the Purusha. You're abiding in this mind, body, sense organs. It's the mind, who is part of Maya, that has this problem. It's the mind that says, I'm the limited individual subject to birth and death. It's the mind that's suffering from the ignorance. And so since you are there, your being, which is infinite and changeless, is there as yourself, the Upanishads can come along and teach the mind, make the mind recognize the difference between itself and you, and recognize its place, the place of the jiva, the body, mind, sense, organ, the upadi, in the scheme of things. And recognize that this whole, in fact, is nothing but has you for its very being, for its reality.
So then consciousness has nothing to do with thinking, and it has nothing to do with any object. It just is kind of a...
It has nothing to do with it except it's the very being of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So your being is not thinking. You are the one who illumines all the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But you yourself aren't thinking. You're present to all the thoughts. Your mind is thinking. If your mind is thinking and you were thinking too, that'd be a real problem. That would be really very noisy.
They're probably a fight.
But you're the one that is central to, you know, that you're the silent, central being, conscious being, that is present to all of this, you know. And from the standpoint of the mind, you think. From the standpoint of your eyes, you see. From the standpoint of the body, you walk. Right? But from the standpoint of yourself, you're completely silent still. And so the jiva, the one who's identified with the body, mind, sense organs, needs to recognize, to differentiate me, the one who is still and whole and complete, from all of this madness, this, all of this ups and downs, all of these comings and goings.
So there's really nothing to achieve, nothing to gain. That the gain is already.
It's the accomplishment of accomplished.
That's a tricky thing.
But the thing is, the gain. There's a lot of gain in accomplishing the accomplished because ignorance causes so much pain. Because of ignorance, you're seeking all over this creation, trying to find yourself. You know, trying to find your well-being. You know, trying to find your stability or some well-being, that something that you can trust, something that you can count on. So the mind, kind of like a vagrant, they use this in one of the Upanishads, like a beggar. It hops from place to place to place, looking for a little place to land, what can feel secure for the moment. You know, and then that gets shaky and it hops around to the next thing. It gets shaky, it hops to the next. But for a jnani, the mind doesn't do that. It sits at home. You know, and then lets the universe hop around. I stay home, and then all of these things go on changing. And some of the things that happen, I like some, I don't like, and all that, but it's not my, I'm not at stake. It doesn't mean that everything, you love everything that's going on, but your well-being isn't at stake. Your ananda's not at stake. You know? And you also see this universe as a whole. You see it as Ishwara. You know, thank God Bhagavan's there to take care of this terrible mess. Let's figure out and see how this all shakes out.
So could we say that the upadhi is a thread of the mind within the illusion of
upadhi? Really just is a technical term for something that causes me to make a mistake. In other words, if my mind can say, I am this body, then this body becomes something that I can misidentify myself with. If I take myself to be this body, then that's a mistake.
Yeah.
That means that this body is functioning as an upadhi. An example they use is, say if I hold up a crystal ball, you know, like a crystal, pure crystal, and I bring a red flower. That red flower makes the crystal appear to be red, right? And if I brought an orange flower, the crystal would change as orange, though the crystal itself has no color. So the flower is acting as an upadhi. It's making the crystal appear as something that it's not. Right? So here, this physical body has the capacity to make me, because of ignorance, take myself to be this. So it's functioning as an upadhi. My mind, if I can say I am my mind, or I am happy, I am agitated, I am sad, I can identify with a quality in the mind, or I'm smart, or I'm stupid. I identify with a quality of the mind, or with a whole mind. Then that mind is acting as an upadhi. My eyes, if I say, you know, I have 20/20 vision, or I'm blind, or I'm losing my sight, the eyes are an upadhi because they are a point of identification.
Just a way to explain the misidentification.
Yeah, or what lends itself for the mistake.
What lends itself, yeah, clearly.
Yeah, that's what's called an upadhi.
So in five koshas are also upadhis, right?
Five koshas are upadhis, and then they're being used then to break these upadhis down in a different way. Like I can say,
they're considered separate upadhis?
So, well, they're kosha. The kosha means that which covers. Covers means it lends itself for a mistake, right? Because in terms of the koshas, these coverings, they're not really covering. You know, like we use the word kosha is like the sheath of a knife, or the the sheath of a blade of grass, you know, mm-hmm. the sheath that covers a blade, that's a kosha. But here we're using kosha in terms of ignorance. So we can say, we can divide the body experience, the jiva, into the three bodies, like the physical body, the subtle body, the causal body, right? Those are three. Or into the five koshas, the physical body, the prana, the anamaya kosha, the pranamaya kosha, the manomaya kosha, the mind, the buddhi, the vijnanamaya kosha, the buddhi, and the anandamaya kosha. These are five points of identification. That's why they act as koshas. So upadhis, yeah. That's right. The three shariras upadhis. We can take everything individually to the prana. If I can say I am that, or I am a quality of that, it's an upadhi.
Through the three shariras?
The stula sharira, physical body. Sukshma sharira, the causal body, the subtle body, which is made up of the pranamaya kosha, manomaya kosha, vijnanamaya kosha. Then the causal body is the same as the anandamaya kosha.
Mm-hmm.
The anamaya kosha is the stula sharira, physical body.
Uh-huh.
They kind of overlap.
Yeah.
They just teaching methodologies.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are used to help you differentiate your being from your experience. You can use the five koshas, the three bodies, the waking dream, you know, subtle, etc., physical, subtle, and causal. Or you can use the waking dream and deep sleep. All of these are meant to help you differentiate the Atma from your experience, right? This Anvayavyatireka is really important. They're all teaching tools. They're called the prakriyas. That are all, they're teaching methodologies to make you recognize yourself. There's a lot of different ones that we use.
Is there a difference between Atman and Purusha?
No, but it's a different. Usually, the Purusha is used for the Atma, which is Brahman,
mm-hmm.
and it really means. The Purusha comes from, if we were to do the kind of the Vedantic etymology, the Purusha, the Purna part is Purna,
mm-hmm.
that which is infinite, limitless,
mm-hmm.
is Purna, absolutely full. Then Purusha also means Purishaya, the one who dwells in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you take both of those and you say the one who is limitless, absolute fullness, Purna, that one is dwelling in the body. Purna is Swarupa Lakshana, right? Limitless. Indwelling in the body. Tatastha Lakshana. So that which is limitless is indwelling in the body. What is limitless can't indwell in the body. But through Tatastha Lakshana, Tatastha Lakshana.
Indirect?
Yeah. You know, like the bird on the.
Yeah.
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 Then you recognize that Purna, the Purusha that is limitless, is to be found in the body or in the heart. Right? Mm-hmm. That's it, Tessa.
That's so beautiful. I hope we can get this class on the computer.
Yeah, we will. There's no
putting everything together to make sense.
You know, with the reference in this verse to, you know, we're making this transition from indirect knowledge to direct knowledge. I don't know if I'm encapsulating this properly, but there seems to be. I guess my question is you've got the part of the Veda that's like the karma kanda.
And that's going to give indirect knowledge.
Right.
Yeah. That's what it's about, it's indirect knowledge. Because karma kanda is talking about what's going on within Maya,
mm-hmm.
within the universe, different levels, that you can't know through your own means of knowledge. If you can know it, that's not the subject matter. Of the Karmakanda. The Karmakanda is meant to give you knowledge which is revealed, knowledge that you can't gain on your own. But it's always about something going on within the creation, and therefore you can't know it through your sense means of knowledge, and so it's indirect knowledge. But now, the Jnanakanda do you punish us? The second part of the Vedas. Then the question is, well, is that giving indirect knowledge also? Like the Tetramasi, you know, or Aham Brahma, you are Brahman. You are that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that some sort of an indirect knowledge or is it a direct knowledge? You know, because if the if the Vedas are giving that which knowledge, which can only be known through the Shastra, but can't be known through your own sense perception or your own means of knowledge, you know, then am I only able to get indirect knowledge of myself? That's the doubt that needs to be answered.
So is the Karmakanda a bridge to that? Is that why it's written?
No. The Karmakanda and the Jnanakanda are the two sections of one Veda. And the Karmakanda deals with the what is going on within Maya, within the samsara.
So when you do the rituals.
With the rituals or dharma, or say you want to know what are the heaven worlds like, what are the hell worlds like, what is the structure of the universe within.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like, say, you have a dream. You're a dream character, and you want to know all about the dream. Like a map of the dream.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the Karmakanda. Now say you want to know, what is this dream? What's the reality of this dream? That's the Jnanakanda.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then the question is, you say that the Vedas give knowledge of that which can't be known through your sense perception, through your means of knowledge. Now obviously in the Karmakanda, well, all that it gives, I have no access to that, you know. But what about then the second part, the Jnanakanda, the Upanishads, do they also only give indirect knowledge, or do they give direct knowledge? Can words give direct knowledge? And so that's how Shankar introduces this. In
when you said that dream thing, that was really cool. Can you say that again? There was two things. What is the reality of this dream, and then what's the...
Okay, say you have a dream, and you're a character in the dream.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to know, you know, all about what's going on in the dream.
Mm-hmm.
Like the map of the dream, you know? What it's all about, or how to function in the dream. And all of the things you can do there. And are there heaven worlds in it? Or, you know, how to find your way around and what's going on. And
right.
Are there heaven worlds and what's the most I can achieve here in this reality? And what's the highest that I can gain here? And, you know, that's the Karmakanda. The Jnanakanda is for the mumukshu, the one who says, yeah, but what is this dream and who am I? What's the truth of it all? That's the Upanishad. Yeah. And that's why, you know, this Etat Satyam, the first part, this is true, relatively true. With they're saying the Karmapala, the Karmapala, this is true what the Upanishad says. So the Upanishad itself is saying, this is the truth. The Karmakanda, with the karmas, will and do invariably give these results. It's the truth. But it's all apeksha. Apeksha means it's all relative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the truth within the changing creation. But now, today it sets in, now for paravidya, this is the truth. This sets in as paramarthika sets in. The truth that is free from time. This is Vyavaharika Satyam. The truth that exists, the empirical reality within time. Within empirical reality, this is true. This is how it works. Now, for absolute reality, this is what it is.
It almost seems like they're talking about two things.
No, because here we are, and you're going to go and get in your car and drive home.
Mm-hmm.
There's an empirical reality. We live it day to day to day.
Mm-hmm.
And this empirical reality has a truth. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
We're experiencing and negotiating everything within the Maya, within this creation.
And there's the underlying.
And then there's the F, then there's the being of this. What is the truth of this? So it's only one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we're operating within it on a given level. And then we want to recognize at some point, well, who am I really? And what is this really?
Mm-hmm.
right? And then you go on driving around.
There's a story about this because it doesn't dismiss
Yeah.
Just to, yeah, it just to make
it's
it
just
clear.
Well, I remember I was asking you about that. You know, there's some, and you refer to it, the academics refer to, oh, this is all an illusion. And you were explaining to me that, you know, someone that's not really familiar with this teaching could interpret it, you know, in academic description as, yeah, this is all an illusion.
Because they'll use the word Maya. Look up the word Maya in the dictionary, it means magic. You know, and then just in common parlance, this world is nitya, it's apparent. Apparent means illusion, but then they don't know what the word apparent means with the word illusion.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Right.
And so it becomes very misunderstood. So that's why for the word nitya, which is often translated as apparent or illusory, you should say dependent reality. That's much better.
Mm-hmm.
Like the clay has the pot has a practical use, but it's also the reality of it is clay,
mm-hmm.
right? The pot is dependent for its being on the clay. That doesn't mean the pot's not there. This world is here. It has an empirical reality. It's you know we function within it, but what is it? What is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is its clay? And its clay is me. I am its clay.
Well, it goes more basic as consciousness than satyam.
Satyam, sat is consciousness.
I guess this before, maybe you're going to say, in this class you said consciousness is the thing. I mean, even though sat is also, but consciousness is...
Well, if we use the words, you have to remember that consciousness is Sat, and
yeah.
Sat is consciousness.
Yeah.
So if I say consciousness is the thing, I'm not leaving out Sat, because consciousness is Sat.
Because
and Sat is
Sat, I could leave myself out.
Well, if you, yeah, because if you say I am Sat, that is true, but the word existence doesn't contain consciousness. Where if you say I am consciousness, consciousness contains existence, or it wouldn't be there. And so, but then the question is there any existence apart from consciousness? Are they two different things? No, because neither one is objectifiable. It's just that existence is consciousness. Consciousness is existence. They're two words that are pointing to the same being.
Isn't it odd that we have to use a compound like that for something so basic? I mean,
but you know why? This is not conscious. The chair is not conscious. The rug's not conscious. So we experience things that exist and are not conscious. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we separate the words. But our self experience is only of conscious being. You know, but we see in the world things that are conscious and things that are not. So this is, and you are, but you are also conscious.
Mm-hmm.
But look at, in the dream, you have a dream. Some of the things exist, some of the things are conscious, exist and are conscious. The ones that have subtle bodies that reflect consciousness, those things I am conscious being. The things that don't have subtle bodies, they just are. They're known, but they themselves don't reflect consciousness. In the dream, everything is known, so there's nothing away from consciousness. But some of the objects are like little mirrors and some aren't. Right? So those are things that have sukshma sharira or subtle bodies, they reflect consciousness. And the things that don't, like a rock, it just is known. The rock's not going to say, I am a rock. The human being, it is as known as the rock, right? But it says, I am the conscious being. Both are equally known. Do you see that? Everything in you, everything is known.
And sometimes it sometimes it isn't personified as a person. Sometimes you just are.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And you're the whole. That's Ishwara. You get to be Ishwara in the dream sometimes.
And so what is that reflecting that mirror quality in the sentiment being?
It's called the subtle body, the mind.
So there's no quote-unquote Atman or Purusha in the rock.
Well, let's put it this way. The Atma is everything. But from the standpoint of the rock, it doesn't have a subtle body to say, I am the Atma. So the rock doesn't make a mistake. Right? It does, the rock doesn't say, I am the Atma, like an Ajnani, and it doesn't say, that I am the whole, like an Ajnani. It doesn't reflect anything. The human being that has a mind, either as an Ajnani says, I am this little individual here, or it says, I am the limitless, I am the whole. Right? If it says, I am the whole, it's referring to the self, which is the whole, not to its limited mind.
But in Vedanta, what's the parlance that refers to that capacity to do that?
Self-reflection? You have to have a mind or subtle body to be able to have that self-reflection. A rock doesn't have that. But you have to remember another important thing is that the conscious being doesn't belong to the mind or to the body or to the rock. The conscious being belongs to conscious being. Right? So the sense of self, the me, has nothing to do with the rock or with the worm or the human being. This me, which is you, it's not something given to you by the upadhi. So it doesn't matter the rock or you are in, or the physical human body or the rock or the animal has, it doesn't make any difference to the sense of me. Because the upadhi doesn't give the me-ness to the me.
Well, let's talk about something.
Does that make sense?
Not a rock, but a cow.
Yeah, well, what I'm talking about that there's no doership. For the self, there is no doership. But what I'm saying is a little different than that. It's okay. Say there's a cow, a human being, and a rock. Okay? The cow says moo, okay? The rock, but it has a sense of I am. It might not talk, but it has a sense, I am the cow. We'll just say that it does. Human being says, as a sense, I am the human being, it says I'm a human being. So the rock doesn't say anything and doesn't think anything. Okay. But the sense of I that makes the cow say or feel I am a cow, and the sense of I that makes the human being feel I'm a human being, that doesn't belong to the human being, it doesn't belong to the cow, it doesn't belong to the rock. It belongs to the I.
So the me is a misidentified I.
Yeah, the me is misidentified as being something that is produced or belongs to somehow the upadhi, or is made to be known because of the upadhi, and it's not. It has nothing to do with the upadhi. That's why you are the whole. That's why you are infinite. That's why you're changeless. That's why when you wake up from a dream, nothing's happened to you. Because nothing has happened to you, because your being has nothing to do with that. It's absolutely irrelevant to your sense of self. And so the rock, just like the rock is not adding or taking away from the self, sense of self, neither is the human being or the cow. Sense of self is Brahman. That's Brahman. That's the one from whom the whole creation comes. So when you say you are Brahman, what you recognize is, oh, me? This me doesn't belong to the upadhi. What makes me does not belong to the upadhi. The upadhi is not giving me. It's not giving me even what I think of. What I think is me, that me is Brahman. What I think is me and that is being given to me by the upadhi, no. That me that you think is you is Brahman. It's not being contributed to by the upadhi.
So my life, so-called my life, really has nothing to do with I.
Because the I is constant.
Yeah. And my life is a series of upadhis.
Yeah.
As a result, from a result of the upadhis.
Yeah, that's right. But it's still you. If it's you're changeless, right?
It's still me, but isn't it worth the distinction of noticing that the changeful one?
That's right.
Even though it's all the same, the changeful one is different than I. Yeah.
What you notice is that amidst all of the changing and all of the activity, you are there changeless.
Yeah.
If you say the changeful one is different than the changing one, that's a little slippery there. Because you have to recognize that the one you identify with as you is always the changeless one.
As you, the...
The me.
The me, the small self.
There is no small self.
Okay. But isn't that the distinction kind of that
you've
been referring to?
You distinguish that you recognize that the me, that when you say me right now, you recognize that is changeless. I am changeless.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, and that I is Brahman. This I that is changeless, this I is Brahman. The I that is changeless is the I that, when you say I, referring to the changeless I, that is me. That is Ishwara. That's the I of the whole.
So you're saying don't make any distinction between me and I.
Right. There is no distinction.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
It's a different question I've been thinking about for a little while. Is it true to say that I sit as the changeless and I project all these life experiences?
No, you would say that the changeless doesn't project anything.
or somehow this mind mechanism projects it?
Well, it would be, see, the mind mechanism, your mind is limited in that your mind is not my mind.
Yeah.
But your mind and body and sense organs are all part of an infinite mind that we call Ishwara. Just like, dream is a good example. If you have a lucid dream, what we would call Ishwara or God is the one who's identified with the total. And then all of the ones inside, the individuals, those are called the jivas. They're part and parcel of the total. So your mind, body, sense organs are part of the whole infinite creation. And you take birth after birth after birth within this infinite creation. But the thing is, this infinite creation comes from you. The self. Right? The dream comes from you, it's sustained by you, goes back into you. So you are both the whole and every part of the whole. There's only one self. The whole comes from the one self, is sustained by the one self, and goes back into the one self. Every individual within that dream says, I am the self, I am the self, I am the self, I am the self. But actually, each one of those parts is part of the whole. And that whole is something that is projected by pure consciousness with Maya. So now I'm going to a little Rizalat tenfold there. So let's stop there.
Yeah.